KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. I'm excited today to have on the show Professor Victoria Stodden of Columbia University, author of a couple of articles, but the primary one that we're going to talk about today is an article called, in draft form, called Software Patents as a Barrier to Scientific Transparency, an Unexpected Consequence of Baidu. So Hearsay Culture is a show, as many of you know, having listened for a number of years, that has focused on a variety of topics relating to technology and information flows. And one of the topics that we've discussed with surprising, perhaps, regularity is university-level innovation and how intellectual property plays a role there. What's going on in the university level in patenting, how Baidu, which is the major federal law involving the transfer of technology from universities into the marketplace, impacts universities. And so we've had a variety of guests on the show that have discussed these issues in one form or another, including professors like George Contreras at American University and Peter Lee at UC Davis and others. And today I'm very excited to have Victoria on because her work focuses even more directly on the question of how intellectual property law impacts the research process itself. How does intellectual property and its role in innovation play when scientists are doing the very research that causes the innovation? And so I've been a fan of Victoria's work for quite a while because A, I think it's very novel, and B, it does dovetail to some degree with my interest in intellectual property and information flows and transparency. And so I've wanted to have Victoria on the show for several years, and finally was able to figure out a way to work her work in. Both in terms of time and in terms of the topics for our show today. So Software Patents as a Barrier, Scientific Transparency, and Unexpected Consequence of Baidu is a statistical analysis of this question of what it is that software patents are doing to the inquiry and research process. Software patents being another topic that's highly controversial and front and center right now in the intellectual property world, which is literally the question of whether, in fact, software should be patentable. And while the Supreme Court has focused on those issues, and while we're not going to spend time on the law per se of those issues today, there are very practical concerns about the impact of patenting on this inquiry process. And so Victoria's study takes really an empirical and statistical approach to this question to see what those impacts actually are. So we're going to spend time today talking about transparency, talking about the scientific inquiry process, talking about the ethic of sharing in the scientific inquiry process, and get to Victoria's stats. Victoria, by way of a brief background, is an assistant professor of statistics at Columbia University. She's affiliated with Columbia's Institute for Data Sciences and Engineering. She focuses primarily, although not exclusively, on these issues. She has developed the Reproducible Research Standard, which is a suite of open licensing recommendations for the dissemination of computational results. She's also the co-founder of a really interesting organization called Run My Code, which is a platform for disseminating the code and data associated with scientific results. She's been awarded a number of research grants from a variety of organizations. She's testified before congressional committees and done a lot of work with the National Science Foundation. Bottom line is she's a terrific guest, and I'm thrilled to have her on the show. So Victoria, who is joining us from her office at Columbia University on October 30th via Skype, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, thank you, Dave. After that introduction, I'm like dying to hear it myself. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you on the show. Like I said, I've wanted to have you on the show for a while, and I'm glad to do it today. So I've rattled off your background a bit, but perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about your background, but specifically how you got into this question of software patents and scientific transparency.
So the question around all my interest in software patents and transparency, it stems from a concern about the reproducibility of the work that we're publishing today as research scientists. And that concern comes from the changes in research that have happened due to technology. So I'll try and make this I'll try and put this in a nutshell. So what's been happening is we, as research scientists, we publish work in the published paper, and that's sort of the coin of the realm, right? We go and we publish this, and it comes out in journals, and our community reads it, or people beyond the community. What's happening as research has become more computational is there's been a few changes. It's become much more complex, and in terms of the actual steps that you take in your research, the computer enables you to do a lot more things than you might have been able to do before we had the computer. And then it's become more, there's actually a whole variety of new research questions that open when you have the computer as a tool. So a lot of my work has been focused around, well, how do we get these levels of transparency that are ideal, in a sense, in scholarly communication? How do we do that in a computational setting? And my argument is that the code and scripts that you use to go from the data to your published results should be available so people can see what you did, just the same way as traditionally you describe what you did in the methods section in a paper. It's just with code, there's just that level of complexity that you really need to get the code out there. And then I also think that it should include any raw data you started from. So if you're doing an empirical project, and you start from data and you're applying computational methods, I think all of this should be open for other people to inspect or run or try, and they can verify your results and make sense of what you're actually talking about in your scientific publication. I think without this, we're facing a real credibility crisis in our communication of computational science. We're communicating empirical work where it's very difficult, if impossible, from the actual published paper to understand what went into generating those findings. So that's part of my motivation here. Really, in my background, I got interested in these issues as a PhD student. I did my PhD actually at Stanford with David Donahoe in the statistics department, and he works reproducibly. And what that means in the context of his research is when he publishes work, he puts the scripts, the software out there, and the data that allows other people to actually implement and run the work that he's done in his publications. And so this was just how we were trained as grad students, and we learned about these concepts that way. And then it's not something that's generally practiced. So I went to actually Stanford Law School after finishing my PhD in statistics, and I started thinking a little bit more about these issues, and I realized that at that point that sharing code, sharing data on the internet, which is the way we had always done it, was fraught with IP issues, and from my experience as a grad student and as a scientist, I knew that those were not being addressed in any kind of coherent way. We were essentially just throwing code and data out there on the web and, you know, hoping people cited us and were able to use it. So then that's where I started thinking about the larger ramifications of this issue. So moving towards something that's called really reproducible research, where code and data are out there with publications, and you can run it, you can get into the software, you can see how things work, you can see how those results were constructed. That's something that I'm very much in favor of moving towards. So the question is, how do we do it? And there's all sorts of barriers and problems and things to work out, and the IP issues are certainly an important part of it.
Now, to make sure that we're able to contextualize this discussion, when you use the phrase computational settings, for those that aren't familiar, what does that mean? What does that mean to the person that is not a PhD student who has been through a PhD program or who is familiar with academic literature?
So the way that I think about that, I think if someone's doing research and you're using a computer at all to generate the results, I consider that computational research. So, for example, a social scientist who goes and collects data around a hypothesis, enters it onto their spreadsheet on their laptop, and then, say, uses a statistical piece of software to analyze the data, I would count that as computational research, and ideally, the scripts and the steps and the software to do that analysis is something that would be shared alongside the actual results. But it goes also right up to scientific computing folks who work on, very powerful systems and do very complicated simulations. And so that's sort of at the other end of the spectrum. But I think if you're using a computer in your work, I think these ideas affect you.
Now, for those who don't think in these terms, right, one of the questions that I think immediately comes to bear, and it's not normally a question I ask this early, but I also think that your focus is a little bit different than what we've done on the show. The question that you will often get in traditional media is, so what, or why should we care? Yeah. And I think we know if you're familiar with research processes, why this matters. But for the person that is not immersed in academic settings or research, why is this an important question for them, and why should they be at least thinking about these issues?
So one of the things that's an open question in scientific research, what's good science? So what actually contributes to our knowledge of the world, and what's actually just kind of wrong or a mistake, or it's just not helpful? And because we don't actually know, you know, the capital T truth, we don't know exactly what is a right contribution and what's a wrong contribution. I mean, if we knew this capital T truth, we wouldn't have to do all this scientific research, right? So the best that we do is we say, okay, so if this is something that we can verify within the community of scientists, then that's where we're going to put our money until something else tells us that we need to be doing something differently. And traditionally what that's meant is when you have a new scientific finding, you explain in detail to other people in the community so they can go and independently try your methods and then come to the same conclusion, and then that bolsters your results. And so that's how science has moved forward. And the issue with computation is it's basically this wonderful tool for science, and it's introduced this level of complexity that makes it very difficult to capture everything, all the information that you would need as a scholar to replicate those results in the published paper itself. So we need to get a little bit more information. We need to get the code and the data, and then that bundle of three things along with your paper will allow other people to regenerate and verify and understand your results. Because without that, we don't understand whether or not we're actually we're shedding light on the problem, or whether or not this is just something, you know, that someone made up. You know, like we just don't have that benchmark for evaluating the work. And so this level of transparency and reproducibility is something that should adhere to all the scientific findings that researchers are putting out there and saying, you know, here's something I found that I think contributes to our stock of knowledge.
Now, I'm going to ask you another kind of semantic in the weeds question, but I think it's important for context. You appear to be using the word code or the name code and the word data as two different things. So what is the difference between code and data in terms of the kinds of information that you believe, and we're going to talk about this shortly, should be more transparent?
So I'm thinking of data as in descriptive information that's collected on people or events, or usually it's numbers, but it can also be text information. And you generally, you know, house this together in some kind of collection. So in a sense, this is, you know, raw information that we haven't yet made sense of. There may be, you know, a huge amount of it, and we need to make sense of it. So that's essentially what I'm thinking about as data. It's static. It doesn't mean that it doesn't change over time, but it's not meant to do anything as an end in itself. That's very different to code and software, where these are essentially computer programs that will implement analysis methodologies typically applied to this data. So, for example, I would do something, I could ask questions like, well, I wonder what the average age of this person in my data set actually is, and then I would write some computer code to go ahead and do that computation based on the data itself. And so the question, so finding the average is somewhat of a trivial example, but the question would be, did I actually find the average correctly? So it would be really great if people also had access to the computer code that I use to do that analysis on the data. And the only way to verify that is having the original data and applying the code as I did and take a look at those results and see if you can find errors in what I did and be skeptical about my work.
We're chatting with Professor Victoria Stodden of Columbia University on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. All right, Victoria, one more foundational question before we get into the substance of your paper. So what is your definition of transparency?
So that's a great question. It's there's no one definition, and it's very contextual. So in the scientific context here, so we tend to use the word reproducibility rather than transparency, and the idea being that when you communicate your scientific findings, you include enough information so that other researchers in the field who have the background can go ahead and replicate your work and can verify your work. And so that's essentially an unsatisfying definition because it doesn't tell you exactly how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in some sense unique to the research problem and unique to the field, and scientists need to make judgment calls about this. And so you can imagine in, say, social science settings, ideally I would be able to work from your initial data sets and use the code that you've written to verify your results. And in other types of research analysis, like simulations and so on, you would have access to, say, the code and be able to regenerate the data and so on that they've generated in the course of their research. And in that way, you would verify it. I also sometimes get this question. Maybe it's actually better if people rewrote the software, or mm-hmm. they recollected the data and they redid the experiment from the beginning. And maybe all they need is that high-level description in the paper, and if they really used the same data and the same software as the original researcher, they're not really doing an independent validation or verification of the work. And I think that it sort of begs the question as to why access to code is so important, because if you do go ahead and you do that independent replication, which is fantastic, I'm willing to bet quite a lot of money that you don't end up with exactly the same results as the original author. And the reason is because the research work is delicate and it's difficult, and lots of decisions are made as you go through the research process. And without access to the original researcher's code as well as your code, how do you actually reconcile those differences, and how do you understand who may be doing something right or interpreted something differently, or maybe someone there's just these differences in the results that are going to remain in a black box, in a sense, unless you can really sort of dig into the software and into the data that generated those results, even just to compare independent replications.
Yeah, it's interesting, Victoria, with regard to that issue and with regard to this broader definition, because as you say, the definition of transparency is contextual. As it stands today, and we're recording on October 30th, The Nation posted an article yesterday with regard to a different form of research transparency, one that involves the financial interests of experts, that is, academics, who are offering opinions on policy matters. And so the transparency that article is referring to is transparency with regard to one's biases or financial interests.
Yeah, that's extremely important, too. So that's something where other scholars have also looked at these issues. So if there are conflicts of interest, or if you're being paid to do a study. So here's the reason I focus on the computational aspects. Those types of biases that are very important and can certainly affect transparency, they've been around a long time, and there are mechanisms in place in research institutions that you are supposed to reveal your conflicts of interest. I have to sign off on a document every year and so on. And these are sort of older problems, in a sense, and there are established mechanisms to deal with it. And maybe they don't work very well, maybe we should revisit them, and so on. Maybe there are issues, but the process itself doesn't change. But what's interesting to me about computation is this is something new that sort of makes you re-question our communication process. It's not really, okay, let's revisit what we've got, and maybe we're not doing it well, or we're not capturing people with conflicts of interest, and we're not bringing these problems to light, or we need to have more enforcement or something. This is really brand new. Like, things like code and data as vehicles for scholarly communication in and of themselves, as well as the research paper, that's something absolutely brand new. And so I think since computational research is so widespread, the way that I defined it at the beginning, basically using a computer anywhere in your research, this is something that affects all sorts of researchers across the landscape on a whole variety of different problems. So I don't mean to you know, sidestep the transparency in research issue. I'm just saying that this is something that, depending on the type of problem that you're facing, you could have a very different way that you implement transparency and reproducibility in your computational work.
And so the relationship there is one very broadly of having information out there, but I think you're suggesting, and I want to make sure I understand, that perhaps the path or mechanism for getting the right information into the right hands is different when it comes to computational issues. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's exactly right. Okay. And I think that publishing computational science the same way that we've always published traditional science doesn't work when it comes to satisfying things like the ability to replicate the results, the ability to understand the results, and the ability to compare different results and build on them. So I'm not the only scientist who has noticed this issue. There are many of them. In fact, there is actually something that's loosely called the reproducible research movement that's coming. People have come independently out of many different fields to say this is a problem. We're publishing this computational science, and we need to have better standards that enable verification of these results.
So there is your tie-in, I think, to the issue, or at least partially the tie-in to the issue of software patents, because that kind of issue of reproducibility, of course, is at the cornerstone of why we issue patents, at least in the United States, but I think in most countries. So in order to make that transition into more of the details of your article, we've talked about it a little bit, but to have that understanding of how patents would impact the process, I think we need to know more about what the ethic of sharing is. So what is your understanding, based upon personal experience and otherwise, of the scientific method as it relates to sharing? What are the generally accepted standards? And I know you've written about this not only in this article, but in previous works.
So science is very special. So we don't, as scientists, we're in this situation where there's some recognition that the work we do is generating a public good in some sense. Like this greater understanding of our world is somehow thought to be something that's in society's interest, that's just generally good for all of us to do. And so you see these billions of dollars of federal research funds that get funneled to support this, and research institutions, and like a huge amount of foundation support and so on. We're not expected to pay our own bills with our work, in a sense. And that's a very, very special situation. And so part of this is there are all these norms around what it means to produce scientific research. And it's not just because of, you know, the type of funding and so on. It's really because we're generating this public good. And so the idea is if we're generating something that's knowledge about our world, everyone should have access to this. So there's this long tradition. See, there's another definition of transparency.
Right.
There's this long tradition in science of making our results widely available. This was the idea of publishing the results. So when you're ready as a scientist, you go out and you communicate your results widely and you publish them. This has also the effect of allowing other people to scrutinize your results and be very skeptical of your results and find all these mistakes. I mean, we're all human, and there's mistakes everywhere in what and all of us do, and science is no exception. And so having this level of openness allows us to make the work as right as we possibly can. And so this is this norm means that we've generally not traditionally ever attached any kind of intellectual property to our work as scientists, with the exception of we'd like credit for it. So we would like people to cite our work, and if it's useful to you, we would like recognition of that. But that's really the only thing we're asking about. Everything else goes essentially out for free. And so that's our whole scientific system. So we've got this whole mechanism for transferring this information. And so that ethic is maybe that's sort of our ideal, but that's what undergirds it. It's this notion that we're creating a public good, and we need to allow people to be skeptical of our work and see everything that we're doing so that we can do the best science that we can and be as right as we can as a community.
So one more question along those lines, and then we'll do a quick break and then come back and start talking about software patents and the impact on universities. So one of your earlier articles involved the question, and you really begin the article by talking about the scientific tradition of sharing and collaboration going back literally to the 1660s. Compare the work of two eminent scholars in the field of scientific inquiry, Merton and Froelich, who have differing conceptions, perhaps to some degree, of what that ethic is. I don't want to summarize their views, except to say that it's an interesting point that you make in this earlier article about whether the research process also involves competition between researchers, right? Reputational impacts and who's the first one to come up with a new idea and so forth. And certainly anyone not just in academia, but anyone involved in the creation of goods and services, right, would understand that interest in being first and wanting to be better or more successful than others in your field and so forth. And for better or for worse, academia is no different. My question, though, is whether that tension between the ideal of sharing, of free inquiry and so forth, versus, you know, perhaps, you know, the realities or the practical concerns involving success in one's career and ability to make money are in any way at odds with each other for the purposes of what we're going to talk about, which is patents. So perhaps you could give us a little bit of a context in terms of the ideal versus the practicality and whether you think that tension really does exist.
So Robert Merton actually described the norms that basically what I was describing earlier, this notion that science is this transparent endeavor where we're creating a public good. And I think some of the pushback that he's received, which you just articulated, is, well, you know, when that actually goes into practice, you see all these kind of human characteristics coming out and so on. So because we've been doing this type of scientific research, essentially trying to do reproducible, verifiable research since Robert Boyle in the 1660s, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of time to work this out. And so one of the things, since we don't know this capital T truth, we use peers to try and evaluate each other's works. Because without this knowledge of capital T truth, we don't really know who's the most successful scientist or who's contributing the most knowledge and so on. So we use peer review. And this has resulted in things like peer review and citation. So recognition for contributing ideas, particularly original ideas, so if you're the first one and so on, presumably you'll pick up lots of citations, and this generally is how scientists are evaluated. So promotion, hiring, and prestige, fame, all of this stuff comes from are you contributing original ideas? Are you picking up citations? And so, of course, that stuff gets very competitive. And the way that I understand how this works is that prior to publication, this is sort of when you're generating the results and you're doing the scientific research, and it's a very creative period for scientific work. My sense is that this is not something that gets the spotlight at that point. You're trying out different methods, you're seeing what works and so on. You're keeping good records of what you're doing, but that's something that you're doing as a private researcher tinkering around. But the moment you want to go public with this and tell people, hey, look, I've got this amazing breakthrough, I've got this finding, you know, check it out. At that point, that's where you really need to share all this information. If you want to share within the scientific community, you have to have these standards of validation and verification so that other people can actually get a handle on your work and try and understand whether or not it's getting closer to this capital T truth or not, and try and contextualize your research. So I feel like there's this bright line at the point of publication, and that helps to reconcile some of this. It doesn't mean that people won't try to advantage themselves as much as possible when they publish and so on. But in my experience, most scientists really do have this desire to do good work, have it vetted, and communicate it. And so I don't think this is an ethical issue in the sense that, you know, we have bad actors who aren't sharing things. This is really more of a structural issue in that the way that science and the scientific practice has solved these issues of transparency in the past just doesn't work anymore with computational research. And so this is really how do we move as a group, as a scientific research community, to communicating extra information that's sufficient to allow this type of replication and verification. So, you know, there are always bad actors in any area, but I don't think this is fundamentally the problem. But I do think more clarity with code and with data, with computational science will help flush out any bad actors that are there, because we'll be able to, the work will just be that much more transparent in terms of what they've done.
We're chatting with Professor Victoria Stodden of Columbia University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that the show is on KZSU, which is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to keep listening. All right, let's pivot, Victoria, to the intellectual property and patent law issues that you focus on in the piece. So again, you know, and I recognize that that we can go deeper, but because this is a topic which is at least on the commercialization of university-based research is not entirely new, and patents are hardly new to Hearsay Culture, so we can move past that a little bit. But I do want to now pivot to your understanding of how commercialization exists in a university. When research is being done by the academics about or on whom you are focusing, how does patents come into their process?
Yeah, it's part of it. And the reason it's part of it was because in 1980, Congress passed this act, the Bayh-Dole Act. And what the Bayh-Dole Act did, but the Bayh-Dole Act did two things. And one is it rationalized the intellectual property rights across the different funding agencies. So there are many different ways to get research funds from the government, and they had sort of different policies about ownership and so on. So it rationalized this. And the other thing that it did is, with the goal of transparency, is there was this idea that, you know, there's a lot of really wonderful patentable inventions that are being developed in academic research institutions that aren't really ever getting out there because, as I said earlier, science in general, the ideas were not motivated by money. It's not business, right? And so the idea was, well, if we gave institutions the ability to patent and license this work, then the institutions would have a financial incentive to make the work transparent and available through the patent system. And otherwise, it would just kind of sit there and no one would really know about it. And so this was great for, you know, the universities can make more money and maybe pay their bills and so on. And also, we're getting inventions and new knowledge out there that could potentially catalyze economic growth and new businesses and commercialization and so on. So I think, I mean, not to impute too much into what people were thinking back then, but I think this was the rationale behind Bayh-Dole. Now, remember, I said that Bayh-Dole was passed in 1980. So these people really had no inkling of the importance that computational methods were going to come to play in science. So the way that I've been looking at this issue is, how does Bayh-Dole interact with these new standards for sharing, this notion of reproducible research in computational science? And there is a big interaction because, of course, software is potentially patentable. If you perhaps you have an algorithm in there, or you have an implementation of an idea that could be patentable. And since Bayh-Dole, universities have interpreted their role of ownership of research in some ways very uniformly and in other ways very differently. Uniformly in the sense that they all stepped up and they said, right, we own this now. So basically, if you get hired as a university researcher, you sign a document that says that you're turning over ownership of any of your discoveries that might potentially be patentable to the university. Some universities require you to disclose anything that may be patentable, and then that's something that they're going to take ownership of, and that's perfectly legal and within their rights, and that's what Bayh-Dole was designed to do. The thing where I see differences in implementation is how they actually, there's lots of, you know, details in the weeds. And so how much choice do they give to the investigator about whether or not to patent? Does the university make that decision, or does the university defer to what the researcher would like to do? And so there are all these kind of implementations. Patents have been something where, you know, entire offices at a university has developed around them. And so now, and I think so one thing that's come out of my research is this notion of software patenting within the academic context is very new, and different universities are grappling with this in different ways. And so you have, you know, some universities that are producing more software, or this seems to be something that their universities are more interested in patenting, and some where it's really not quite on the radar yet. So this is something where, you know, universities are doing this in very different ways so far.
So when we talk about software patents, I mean, this is a highly controversial area in patent law. We're talking about, to be absolutely clear, right, the notion that someone has monopoly-type ownership over a computational method, as you've previously described it, correct?
Yeah, so, or that particular implementation. And code is very interesting in a few ways as a research output. So there are very big norms against, for example, plagiarism in research that have been around hundreds of years. It would be really bad if, Dave, I was cruising around on your website and I grabbed one of your papers and I just, like, erased your name and put my name on it and then went and said it was mine, right? So this would be terrible plagiarism. But on the other hand, software is very different. So if you write some code and it works well on a particular platform and so on, and I've got a similar platform, and I go and I grab your code, everyone expects that I would take it verbatim and just start using it. So in this sense, this what plagiarism means and so on is different when it comes to software. Again, I would hope within scientific norms that I would credit you and so on. So this has something to do with the utility of software when it comes to patents. So for example, it's not something where the actual instantiation of that code is actually important. So you have this embodiment of the idea in software, and that's actually useful because, like I said, I don't need to sort of necessarily implement the method in a different way or whatnot. Often I can just actually use your software, and it's almost a waste for me to just change it for the sake of it. I mean, if it works as is, I should just use it. And so that's part of how patenting starts to impact scientific research. The way that I really see there to be an impact is now you have these competing ends, in a sense. So this is something that is just coming to the fore for people to think about. But if you think about those researchers I mentioned earlier who are involved in this reproducible research movement where they think code should be made openly available, the openness that they're thinking about is as open as going to someone's website, downloading the code, or going to a code repository and just clicking and you've got the code. It's open to them doesn't mean, you know, calling or emailing a tech transfer office at a university, trying to negotiate access to this, explaining you have research ends in mind, and so what would the licensing fees be in that situation, and so on. It's just a non-starter. And so one of the things that I think is important is being able to accommodate the needs of reproducible research and very open access to code with the patent system. And this is something we're just on the cusp of. Like, I believe that patenting and software and so on is just something universities are starting to become aware of or become interested in. But this can't stop the open availability of software that underlies published research for other researchers to do replication. I actually think it extends further than that. I think it shouldn't be these notions of reproducibility shouldn't be restricted to, say, the academic community. I think we should have wide availability of code data for people to get involved in understanding this work and testing it out and so on. But one thing that I've been thinking about is that maybe it makes sense to have openness in the sense of sort of click to download for the research community. And then if there is a patenting interest that is concordant with Vidal, and then have a sort of full-on patent licensing and so on for non-research interests, say, for example, commercial development interests.
So we're chatting with Professor Victoria Stodden of Columbia University on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Victoria, let's get into the results of your study. So the basic question, right? So do patents decrease transparency as you've defined it? And if so, what is the effect?
So it's really early. Like the first question that I had with the empirical work is, well, how much are universities actually patenting software at all? Is this even a question that we need to worry about? So I dug around and it turns out, yes, they are patenting and yes, it is increasing, but the numbers are still not huge. So, this is something that people are still sort of getting their minds around as a patenting entity, or a patentable entity that universities might be interested in. And so this is something where I did a survey of one part of the machine learning community a couple of years ago, and one of the researchers identified for me reasons for not making their code available, and reasons were things like, well, I would like to actually file a patent, and I'd like to start a company around this code, and so on. And this is a direct output of Bayh-Dole. And this is not something, this is great, you know, if someone wants to start a company and so on, I mean, you know, this is really a wonderful output of research. On the other hand, I think we need to be very careful about the norms, that science operates under, that pushes science forward, versus business interests. And so I think we need to be very careful about sort of the entrepreneurship hat versus the academic researcher hat and not mix them. If you remember, as I said earlier, we have a lot of resources that flood to scientists because it's thought that we're doing this research in the public interest, in a sense, that we're making all of our findings available. And we need to make them available for to create reliable research that other people can verify. And so if researchers are being either by their own incentives or forced by a university to patent software that is part of understanding and replicating results, then that's something that can break that sort of ability to produce and really reproducible research. So I think it's this very delicate issue that we need to think about, and I think this primary should be around the quality of the science, and the quality of the science only comes from reproducible research.
Victoria, with regard to those questions, I'm curious. Scientists themselves, right, are, as we've discussed, involved in research and commercialization, or this kind of issue involving patents has really been, as you pointed out, a more modern problem. And I'm curious, in the research process, if you have a sense of it based upon either this paper and your own empirical research or your own experience, how conscious, if you will, are research scientists of patents and questions of patents and patent law and so forth? Because it would seem like at that level alone, the impact on not only the transparency, but the research itself could be profound. Is that implicated in your data, or do you have opinions in that direction?
Well, so it really depends on the subfield. I think in some areas there is really, they operate with a lot of collaboration with industry, for example, and there's a lot of knowledge of IP issues. I think that's not true for most computational scientists. One of the luxuries that the scientific community has had for a very long time is because of their norms of sharing and largely ignoring IP, with the exception of recognition and citation, they basically lived in this little happy vacuum, you know, around IP rights. And Bayh-Dole started to change this, and it changed it in a couple of ways. It changed it because potentially there are financial incentives now for the researcher, and it changed it because, you know, we all work in research institutions that are now making rules that affect us about our discoveries. And then the other thing that's changed it, of course, is computation and software. And so we've got these things that are very different from when Bayh-Dole came to be. So I think there's a growing awareness among researchers of these patent abilities, but we just don't really have a tradition around working within an IP structure. This idea of putting code out on the web, you know, that's really quite new over the last, say, 10, 20 years, and there isn't really this sort of general awareness of what that means. I mean, I realize we're talking about patents, but, you know, even copyright issues and basic permissioning that you would need to do to permit others to use your work, generally speaking, that's not something that's widely known or recognized in the scientific community. We just haven't had to operate in that world.
So, Victoria, I'm now at the point in the show, and we have about 10 minutes left, where I start asking what I call the unfair questions. And they're unfair because you may not have the time left to answer them with the level of thoroughness that you would have previously enjoyed. But as the host of the show, I do the questions anyway. And I've not had anyone in 190-plus shows hang up on me. But, you know, certainly if you think the question goes too far, you're welcome to push back. So I'm curious, again, it's a really interesting paper, and I look forward to your future work on this topic. And in fact, I invite you back to discuss it once you've gotten even deeper into it. But one of the things you point out specifically are that, and you've written about this previously as well, the disclosure or lack thereof results directly from these commercial partnerships, or at least there's a suggestion of it. Perhaps you could tell us a little about the nature of those partnerships. In other words, when you have funding or collaboration between a university and a for-profit commercial entity, what is that relationship like? I know that's, and that's why I said it's an unfair question. It's a big question, but can you describe the contours of that relationship itself?
Yeah, well, okay, so they can be very unique, actually, and very different depending on the type of research that's being done and the norms within the field and what the industry partner expects to get out of this. But there is a lot, particularly in biotechnology, there's a lot of industry collaboration. And you could even say Bayh-Dole is responsible for this in a way. And you could say, well, one of the flip sides in industries outside biotech that are potentially patenting, say in in electrical engineering or other places where there's algorithmic development, maybe it's actually encouraging collaboration with industry. Again, I think we need to be very careful what hat we've got on. Do we have an academic researcher hat on, or do we have an entrepreneurship hat on, and keep those roles very separate. The other thing I think that these industry partnerships are figuring out is that the norms between the two universes, like the academic research and industry research worlds, are not identical. So, for example, I have heard of situations where, you know, you get to the end of a project in a collaboration, and the academic researcher intends to make the data available or code available. And this is shocking to the industry partner, who expected to retain some proprietary rights over this and doesn't want it just made openly available, where that's very natural to the academic researcher. We would just make things, you know, available. And so one of the things that I've advocated for is I think the universities could serve a role here to help smooth this over by having some template agreements up front on what's going to happen to the data, what's going to happen to software output, is this something that gets shared with the academic community, for example, and how do we do this going forward? To my knowledge, I don't think those templated agreements actually exist, but I think that will be a nice step forward to avoid this kind of confusion when you get to the end of a project. What happens to data? What happens to code? Is this something in the service of a public good and in the service of furthering science as an open endeavor? Is this something that is seen as part of the industrial collaboration and proprietary IP rights are assigned to this, and maybe it goes to the industry? That's something that generally speaking, my understanding is that it's still very murky and doesn't get sorted out at the beginning of the project, which I think it would make a lot of sense for the science and for the collaboration if that was sorted out.
To the extent that you've actually discussed your results, Victoria, with research scientists, what's been their reaction? And maybe you haven't had those discussions, but I'm curious.
I've had a lot of those discussions.
So what have they said?
So this is really interesting. I've been giving talks around this topic of reproducibility. The patenting talks have been more recent, but around this larger notion of reproducibility in computational science. And I think in some talks about 3 or 3.5 years ago, I actually got scoffed at and so on. People thought this was like I was talking about things that didn't make any sense or were impossible in their context and so on. And then about 18 months or 2 years ago, I don't know what happened, but everything changed. I no longer had to give framing talks, bringing attention to this notion of reproducibility in computational science and why it might be important, but the talks changed to how do you implement it. And the reason is because the audience changed. Now the questions I started getting about 18 months, 2 years ago, were not doubtful, but how do I do this? You know, I'm on board with what you're talking about in reproducibility. How do I implement it in my lab? What can I do as a department chair? As an individual researcher, how should I be supervising my postdocs so they're doing this? I've got a really complicated research process. Are there tools I can do, I can use to sort of help gather this information so I can share my code and my data better? I've never had anyone actually push back on the notion of reproducibility. The scientists all understand this, but it's been very interesting that now I believe this is actually widely accepted that we need to have code and data access, and the question is how do we move there as a group? One thing I should mention is that preparing code, preparing data for public release is non-trivial. It takes extra work, and if you... especially if you imagine a junior scientist taking extra time to prepare code and data and making it available, very little academic credit at this point accrues to that. And in a sense, they're better off taking that time instead of investing it in doing reproducible research and producing the next paper that they do get credit for. And that is something that, you know, the tenure committee pays attention to and so on. So this is something where really we've got a collective action problem that a few people who are trying to do reproducible research can't kind of, you know, hurt their careers over it in a sense. So we all sort of need to move there together. And I think one thing that, so this is the unfair question because we don't really have time to talk about this, but there have been steps by the White House and also it looks like steps by Congress to bring about transparency in data for federally funded research. So, I'm not a fan of, you know, the heavy hand of the government trying to tell scientists what to do. On the other hand, we're facing this collective action problem, and we do kind of need to move to transparency and data and code together to avoid, you know, sort of the early adopters being hurt by doing this. So in general, I get very positive reactions on this, and people are hungry for information on how they can actually do this. I don't generally get too much pushback with the conflict with patenting, but that may be because this is just a brand new research topic for me, and I haven't spoken about it as much.
With the same question with regard to the extent you've talked to them, patent scholars and people in the IP community. To the extent you've chatted with them, and I know I saw your paper at the IP Scholars Conference earlier this year. What's been their reaction, if any?
Oh, so they're so encouraging because I think this. This is something, like, my approach comes from a scientific grounding, and this gives a certain perspective on it that may be novel in this community. And so, that's something where I think, I feel like there's been an amazing reception, actually, and a lot of interest in my work in sorting this out, especially coming at patents from the computational angle. There's quite a bit of research over the last decade or two about the intersection of patents and biotech research, for example. But what I'm doing is really on the computational side and broader than, say, biotech and software patenting. And so how this interplays with the academic community is, in my experience for the IP scholars in the legal community, something I think they found fascinating. I mean, at least that's how it looked to me. You know?
No, and I think, look, I mean, like I said, I think this, at the beginning, this intersection of intellectual property transparency is a personal interest, but I think it also, of course, you know, pervades IP law, even if I think it's an area that, requires more exploration, which is why, on a personal level, I'm excited about your work. Victoria, given how active you are and all the projects you're working on, I'm curious, in about a minute or so, can you give us a heads up on what you're working on now? I know this paper is in draft form, although if you want to and you don't have to, you could tell us whether, I don't know if it's been accepted for publication or what have you, but be that as it may, what are you working on now?
So there's two papers I'm working on now, and one is this one, and another one, I don't want to reveal too much because we're just about to submit it, so it's still so early. But I'm very interested in how well journal policies work. So there's been a subtext in our conversation that federal funding agencies have a lot of influence over scientific research, and that's absolutely true. Another lever of influence is, well, what are journals requiring for publishing your work? and they have all sorts of standards, like you have a method section and you have all this stuff, and now they started to adopt standards around code and data disclosure as well, particularly very high impact journals. And so I'm very interested in how effective are those policies. So that's my teaser on my next
paper. Well, thank you for the teaser, and as someone who writes about trade secrecy, I understand. Victoria Scotton, professor of statistics at Columbia University, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. Like I said, I'm a fan of your work. I appreciate you taking the time, and I sincerely invite you back on as you finish this paper and focus on related and different areas.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. I mean, this has been a lot of fun, and I'd love to come back.
Terrific. Thank you. I'm happy to at least list at this point the remaining guests on Hearsay Culture's fall quarter schedule. Coming up next week, Denise Howell of This Week in Law, a podcast that I'm a big fan of, and we're going to actually be talking a little bit, I hope interesting, but inside baseball with regard to podcasting itself and the law. And then the following week, Professor Chris Spring of New York University on NSA spying. Dan Nazer of the Electronic Freedom Foundation on patent trolls or non-practicing entities and patent law generally. And then the last show of the quarter, December 4th, will be show number 200 for Hearsay Culture, and I'm going to announce the plans for that show soon. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen via live air, old time, and modern radio. By tuning in to KZSU on Wednesdays at 2 o'clock Pacific time, and that is either by tuning in the Bay Area or by streaming at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can pick it up as a podcast after it airs on KZSU by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 190 previous shows and get the upcoming schedule, and you can also get it by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, or by going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlog.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. I should note, by the way, I wanted to note this at this point on the show. I get occasional feedback with regard to engineering. And this is, you want to talk about inside baseball, the sound quality. And I do my best with the time and resources that I have to make the show as listenable as possible. And I mean that not only obviously substantively, and about that I'm quite proud, but also from an engineering perspective, and I recognize there that that's something that can occasionally improve. But I want you to know that I'm attempting to be on top of the issue, and I welcome any feedback with regard to those particular issues as well. Otherwise, I am also booking guests for the winter quarter. The winter quarter on KZSU begins roughly at the end of the year and into January and February. So any suggestions you have and other feedback, you can offer to me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you very, very much for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.